History, the show where we share our favorite stories from Boston history. This is episode 42, Total Eclipse of the Podcast. Hi, I'm Nikki.
And I'm Jake. We're going to have a short show this week because your humble hosts are away chasing the total solar eclipse. We'll cover our historical anniversaries and talk about the history of eclipses in Boston. So with that, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history.
Today is August 21st, and on August 21st, 1765, the first fire engine made in Boston fought its first fire. It wasn't the first fire engine used in Boston. That honor would go to a hand-pumped engine that the town acquired in 1653, although that contraption failed when called on to fight its first fire. In 1678, a more successful engine was imported from London and put into use. Finally, blacksmith David Wheeler came up with a locally made model. A History of Boston notes, "The first fire engine made in Boston was built by David Wheeler, a blacksmith in Newbury, now Washington Street. It was tried at a fire on August 21st, 1765, and found to perform extremely well. Unlike that 1653 pump, which was made in Lynn, we might add."
The woman who would be known as Elizabeth Freeman was born into slavery and sold to the Ashley family of Western Massachusetts in 1746. The Ashleys referred to her as Mum Bet and didn't treat her especially well. At one point, Mrs. Ashley hit her in the face with a red-hot poker, leaving a scar that would last for life. Soon after that incident, Mum Bet chose to leave the Ashley household. After hearing a public reading of the newly ratified Massachusetts State Constitution in 1780, Elizabeth tried to win her freedom legally. She retained a lawyer named Thomas Sedgwick, who agreed to take her case, adding another enslaved man named Brom to bolster the shaky legal standing of women of all races at that time. In Article 1 of the State Constitution, John Adams argued for the natural freedom and fundamental equality of all people. All men are born free and equal and have certain natural, essential, and unalienable rights, among which may be reckoned the right of enjoying and defending their lives and liberties, that of acquiring, possessing, and protecting property, in fine, that of seeking and obtaining their safety and happiness. On August 22, 1781, the Court of Common Pleas ruled in Elizabeth's favor. It is considered by the court adjudged and determined that the said Brom and Bet are not, nor were they at the time of purchase of the original writ, the legal negro of the said John Ashley during life, and that the said Brom and Bet do recover against the said John Ashley the sum of 30 shillings lawful silver money. The Mum Bet case, along with a parallel case brought by the enslaved man Quack Walker that was heard by the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, brought an end to slavery in the state. These test cases held that the concept of liberty imagined by John Adams and ratified by the state of Massachusetts was incompatible with slavery. Elizabeth took the last name Freeman. The Ashley family invited her to come back and work for them for wages, but she refused. Instead, she accepted an offer from her lawyer, Thomas Sedgwick, to work as a governess to his children. Asked about her pursuit of freedom years later, Elizabeth Freeman would say, "Any time while I was a slave, if 1 minute's freedom had been offered to me, and I had been told that I must die at the end of that minute, I would have taken it, just to stand 1 minute on God's earth a free woman."
Wednesday is August 23rd. If you listen to episode 12, you know that this podcast believes that Sacco and Vanzetti were probably innocent. At least one of them. The Italian-American anarchists had been convicted in 1921 of a robbery and murder in South Braintree. But the evidence was scant, and it seems likely that they were convicted because of their unpopular political beliefs and a wave of anti-immigrant bias in America. Future Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter wrote a review of the case for The Atlantic, saying, "I assert with deep regret, but without the slightest fear of disproof, that certainly in modern times Judge Thayer's opinion stands unmatched for discrepancies between what the record discloses and what the opinion conveys. His 25,000-word document cannot accurately be described as otherwise than a farrago of misquotations, misrepresentations, suppressions, and mutilations." Both men were sentenced to death by electrocution. After their appeals were exhausted, the two men were executed at Charlestown State Prison soon after midnight on August 23rd, 1927. Sacco's last words were, "Farewell, mother," While Vanzetti took a moment to thank his guards for their humane treatment and said, "I want to forgive these people for what they are now doing to me." In the wake of the executions, protests and violent demonstrations swept the world. 20,000 people protested on Boston Common that morning, while mass protests turned violent in England, France, Holland, Switzerland, and Germany. There were protests in Japan and South Africa, and a series of general strikes in South America. Later that year, H.G. Wells would sound a note of caution about the precedent set in the Sacco and Vanzetti case. Executing political opponents as political opponents after the fashion of Mussolini in Moscow, we can understand. Or bandits as bandits. But this business of trying and executing murderers as Reds or Reds as murderers seems to be a new and very frightening line for the courts of a state in the most powerful and civilized union on earth to pursue. In 1977, Governor Michael Dukakis issued a proclamation saying that the duo had been unfairly tried and convicted, and that any disgrace should be forever removed from their names.
On August 24, 1783, Abigail Adams wrote to John with a reminder of the fertility of the earth, and a warning about the deadly measles. "To the blessings of peace we have that of plenty added. The earth yields in abundance. Ceres flourishes with her sheaves and her cornucopia. Pomona cannot boast of being so richly laden. Boreas committed a robbery upon her in infancy, which she is not like to recover, and the plague of Egypt followed him. Our son Charles has just recovered from the measles, and is going again to Haverhill. I wish his brother Tom had been here to have had them with him. My niece, too, has had them and recovered, though it has proved very mortal in Boston. 'Tis said 300 children have been buried since last March. Again, everybody, vaccinate your kids."
Friday is August 25th. Boston founder John Winthrop's journal entry of August 25th, 1635, records a terrible occurrence. The wind having blown hard at south and southwest a week before, about midnight it came up at northeast and blew with such violence, with abundance of rain, that it blew down many hundreds of trees near the towns, overthrew some houses, and drove the ships from their anchors. This was the first hurricane ever experienced by the English settlers of North America. By today's standards, it was probably a strong Category 3 or possibly a Category 4 storm, with winds topping 135 miles per hour and a storm surge of about 21 feet. Unlike the storms of recent years, which have been downgraded to tropical cyclones or tropical storms, the 1635 storm hit Boston at full intensity. A 2006 analysis by the National Hurricane Center estimates that this was the most powerful storm to ever strike New England. Reverend Anthony Thatcher, who was on a ship bound for Marblehead with his entire family when the storm hit, recorded the event in a letter to his brother. "Before daylight, it pleased God to send so mighty a storm as the like was never felt in New England since the English came there, nor in the memories of any of the Indians. In the storm, his ship was sunk. All his children were killed, and he and his wife were tossed up on an uninhabited island. Among the wreckage, they found a flint, a powder horn, a goat, and a block of cheese. With these, they were able to survive until a ship passed by a few days later. Today, their refuge is called Thatcher Island, just off Rockport, Massachusetts."
We heard last week that the first act of resistance against the Stamp Act was to burn the tax collector Andrew Oliver in effigy. A few nights later, the mob took to the streets again. On August 26, 1765, a crowd of drunken Bostonians descended on the house of Oliver's brother-in-law, Lieutenant Governor Thomas Hutchinson. Hutchinson sent his family away, barred the doors, and escaped to a neighbor's house moments before the mob broke through his front door with an axe. They looted all his valuables and liquor, and even began tearing down the house itself. In a letter, Hutchinson said, "Not contented with tearing off all the wainscot and hangings and splitting the doors to pieces, they beat down the partition walls, and although that alone cost them near 2 hours, they cut down the cupola, or lantern, and they began to take the slate and boards from the roof, and were prevented only by the approaching daylight from a total demolition of the building. The garden fence was laid flat, and all my trees, etc., broke down to the ground. Such ruins were never seen in America. Besides my plate and family pictures, household furniture of every kind, my own, my children, and servants' apparel, they carried off about 900 pounds sterling in money and emptied the house of everything whatsoever, except a part of the kitchen furniture, not leaving a single book or paper in it, and have scattered or destroyed all the manuscripts and other papers I've been collecting for 30 years together, besides a great number of public papers in my custody. Though the mob's rage against the Stamp Act was sated, the loss of Hutchinson's papers was an untold loss for Massachusetts. He was a prolific historian, eventually publishing a 3-volume history of Massachusetts. Surely there were irreplaceable primary sources for historians among the papers that were destroyed.
Finally, Sunday is August 27th. Boston founder John Winthrop recorded a deadly disaster in Boston Harbor in his journal entry for July 27th, 1640. The Mary Rose, a ship of Bristol of about 200 ton lying before Charlestown, was blown to pieces with her own powder, being 21 barrels. About dinner time, the powder took fire, no man knows how, and blew all up the captain and 9 or 10 of his men and some 4 or 5 strangers. There was one man saved, being carried up in the scuttle and so let fall in the same into the water, and being taken up by the ferry boat, near dead, he came to himself the next morning, but could not tell anything of the blowing up of the ship or how he came to be there. The rest of the dead bodies were found after, much bruised and broken. 21 barrels of gunpowder must have made quite an impressive explosion, as a witness described how the force of the blast drove a 20-shilling coin into a wooden post. Of course, since this was Puritan Boston, Winthrop blamed the explosion on the fact that the captain and crew were many of them profane scoffers at us, and at the ordinances of religion here. So, clearly, God blew up the ship because the captain didn't attend church while he was in port.
Now, we're down in Nashville this weekend, hoping for good weather to catch the first total solar eclipse of our lives. Back in Boston, you'll be able to see the eclipse, but it won't be total. As we were getting ready for the trip, we wondered whether Bostonians had ever been treated to a total eclipse, and if so, when the first one was. I'm sure there were earlier eclipses, but the documentation isn't great before the Revolutionary War. First one I could find a record of that was visible from Massachusetts was on November 14th, 1659. Now, just as a reminder, a solar eclipse occurs when the moon passes between the sun and the earth, casting its shadow on the earth and causing darkness during daytime. An eclipse can be annular, where the moon appears to be smaller than the sun and causes a ring of fire effect. Or it can be total, where the moon appears to be the same size as the sun and completely obscures it. Because of the relative orbits of the Earth and the moon, the path of totality during an eclipse tends to be just a few miles wide and hundreds or thousands of miles long. The 1659 eclipse was partial, meaning that the sun was not entirely obscured. The records of the town of Salem say, "An eclipse of the sun began presently after 7 o'clock in the morning, continued till 9:30. There were a couple of important eclipses during the American Revolution. During an eclipse on June 24th, 1778, the path of totality stretched from Mexico, across the American Southeast, and even into Northern Africa. Here in Boston, we were outside the totality, but still treated to a partial eclipse. In an 1806 book on eclipses, the author uses a scale of digits to measure partial eclipses, with each digit being equal to 1/12 the diameter of the sun. He says, "In the year 1778, June 24th, there was a great eclipse of the sun. As seen from Boston, it was about 11 digits, the north side of the sun being visible in the middle of the eclipse. That's over 90% obscured, which must be a very dramatic sight. The only solar eclipse I can remember happened in the 90s, and I don't think the sun was over half obscured from where I was at the time."
The path of totality in 1778 passed right over Virginia, but those of us who are on Team Adams will be satisfied that Jefferson did not have the pleasure of observing it. He wrote in a letter to a friend, "We were much disappointed in Virginia generally on the day of the great eclipse, which proved to be cloudy. In Williamsburg, where it was total, I understand only the beginning was seen. At this place, 11 digits only were supposed to be covered, as it was not seen at all till the moon had advanced nearly 1/3 over the sun's disk. Afterwards, it was seen at intervals through the whole. The egress particularly was visible. It proved, however, of little use to me for want of a timepiece that could be depended on."
Things would get a little bit more interesting just 2 years later. The eclipse of October 27th, 1780 was expected to be about 10 digits, or 80% obscured when viewed from Boston. However, that time a party from Harvard set out to do exactly what we're doing this week. They would travel from Boston to chase the path of totality. For them, that meant going north. Totality was expected to be visible from the Penobscot Bay along the coast of Maine. Unfortunately, we were still in the middle of our war for independence at that time. And even more unfortunately, the Penobscot Bay was being held by a strong British garrison. Just a year before, the Massachusetts Navy and militia had taken a large party to Maine and laid siege to Fort George in an attempt to dislodge the British forces there. If you listen to episode 25 about the court-martial of Paul Revere, you know that the siege ended in disaster. Every American ship was sunk or burned, and the militia was scattered into the forest and forced to walk back to Boston overland. Needless to say, the British were not dislodged. Now, a professor of mathematics named Samuel Williams convinced John Hancock to write a letter to the British commander of that same fort, Colonel Campbell, asking for safe passage for Williams and his party to observe the eclipse from that area. Surprisingly, Campbell agreed, though he placed strict limits on where the party would be allowed to land, as he didn't entirely trust any ships from Massachusetts after the hijinks the previous summer.
Williams was also able to convince the Massachusetts Board of War to fit out the state galley with proper stores and accommodation for the conveyance of the Reverend Samuel Williams, Hollisian Professor of Mathematics and Natural Philosophy at the University of Cambridge, and such attendants as he may think proper to take with him, to make the aforesaid observation on the central and total eclipse of the sun. Upon arriving in Maine, Colonel Campbell refused to allow the party to set foot on the mainland, instead forcing them to land on a large island in Penobscot Bay. Though disappointed that he wouldn't have freedom of movement, Williams calculated that the island was within his desired area. Unfortunately, the maps he had been given to work with contained a slight inaccuracy, and he was actually just a few miles outside the path of totality. The longitude of the place of our observation agrees very well with what we had supposed in our calculations, but the latitude is near half a degree less than what the maps of this part of the country had led us to expect. On this account, our situation, instead of falling within the limits of total darkness, proved to be very near the southern extremity. Despite this setback, he made detailed scientific observations of the eclipse that would be useful for geographers and to improve ocean navigation. He also took a moment to step back and reflect on the magnificence of the event. From the beginning of the eclipse unto the time of the greatest obscuration, the color and appearance of the sky was gradually changing from an azure blue to a more dark and dusky color, until it bore the appearance and gloom of night. As the darkness increased, a chill and dampness was very sensibly felt. In 1 hour and 19 minutes, when the light and heat of the sun were rapidly decreasing, there fell 2/3 as much dew as fell the night before or the night after the eclipse. To this we may add, so unusual a darkness, dampness, and chill in the midst of day seemed to spread a general amazement among all sorts of animals. Nor could we ourselves observe such unusual phenomena without some disagreeable feelings.
Finally, in 1806, Boston was treated to a total solar eclipse, the first since Europeans settled on Massachusetts Bay. It came on June 16th, just after 11 a.m. NASA's eclipse calculator tells me that at my house, totality would have begun at 11:10 and lasted for 4 minutes and 42 seconds. An 1860 article in the New York Times describes the event. Probably no eclipse that has happened since the settlement of the country caused as much excitement as this, and even now, it is frequently alluded to by the fortunate spectators of the phenomenon. Indeed, it took place under a rare coincidence of favorable circumstances. The day was cloudless, the total obscuration occurred near noon, when the augmentation of the moon's diameter for its altitude is the greatest, and its apparent motion from the sun in longitude the slowest, and also at a time when the sun was about at its greatest distance from the Earth. The duration of the total eclipse was therefore very long, and nearly as long as it can be. Much as Williams had observed amazement among all sorts of animals during the 1780 eclipse, the cows on Boston Common seemed pretty amazed by the 1806 eclipse. Benjamin Bussey, founder of Harvard's Bussey Institute of Biology, recorded that the cows on the common, we are told, discovered sensible marks of agitation. Some of them left the ground and proceeded homeward. Rest gathered around a person who was crossing the common at the time and followed him with apparent anxiety, as if soliciting protection.
A month before the eclipse, Andrew Newell had published a booklet called Darkness at Noon, telling people what to expect during the eclipse. In it, he recommended eclipse viewing methods that would make your mother cringe. These are definitely not NASA-recommended safe techniques. Newell first says that if you don't have access to a telescope, perhaps the best substitute is one of the dark glasses of a common quadrant. Editor's note. Don't use common sunglasses to view the eclipse. You will burn your retinas out. Only special solar glasses are safe. Newell then goes on to recommend using a mirror to reflect the sun into the dark glass of a common quadrant. Don't do this either. The author then goes on to offer perhaps the worst advice of all. Those who are not possessed of any of the contrivances above mentioned must have recourse to a piece of common window glass, smoked on both sides sufficiently to prevent any injury to the eye. The glass should be several inches square to be used with good advantage, and it will be much more convenient than a small piece. The smoke of a common lamp is probably the best for this purpose, as the glass will not be so liable to crack. If you want to observe Monday's eclipse a little more safely, Boston Public Library is making solar eclipse glasses available at most of their branches on a first-come, first-served basis. Many branches will also have educational programs about eclipses. Call your local branch to see what they have planned. You can also make a safe viewer if you're crafty. An improvised pinhole camera will work, and the lens of your binoculars can be used to project an image of the sun onto a piece of cardboard. If all else fails, stand under a tree and look down. Between the shadows of the leaves, tiny images of the partially eclipsed sun will be projected onto the ground. Our partial eclipse will begin at 1:28 on Monday, August 21st. The maximum extent of the eclipse will be reached at 2:46 p.m., and at its peak, the sun will be 63% obscured. That's just about 8 digits, less than both the 1778 and 1780 partial eclipses we discussed, but still a dramatic sight to see. We wish you clear skies and safe retinas.
To learn more about Boston's 1806 total eclipse, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/042. We'll have a video with tips for how to make a safe eclipse viewer, and we'll have a link to information about when and for how long you can view the eclipse in Boston. We'll also link to Samuel Williams' notes on the 1780 eclipse and to the book Darkness at Noon, or The Great Solar Eclipse of the 16th of June, 1806. And of course, we'll have links and sources for all of this week's historical anniversaries.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We are Hub History on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode. And if you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, please think about writing us a brief review. It is the best way to help others discover the show.
That's all for now. We'll be back next week.